Brunch is back, ladies and gentlemen, and Yelp Guest Manager is here to help the Sunday Funday crowd find your restaurant. Yelp Guest Manager is the no-fee way to fill your tables, so prepare to spend less. But you're also getting a whole lot more. We're plugging your restaurant into the biggest consumer network in the U.S., creating massive awareness with the folks looking to book now. Sign up for Yelp Guest Manager today to get delayed billing for 60 days to start the brunch season off right. Go to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to grow your restaurant, not your expenses. Terms apply. Now here we go.
I just can't tell you how much it's working, but we are in business. We're doing well. We have loyal customers. They're happy. They're our brand ambassadors out there because I like brand ambassadors. And they will tell other people about, you got to eat at Hannes Pretzel. And I've been around for 18 years against all the big guns in the city. And I think there's something to it.
Welcome to Full Comp, a show offering insight into the hospitality industry, featuring restaurateurs, thought leaders, and innovators. Served up on the house. Are you on track to hit your profitability goals for this year? If you're struggling to hit your numbers, I might be able to help. Here's how I do it. Every year, I offer 5 complimentary growth sessions to restaurant owners looking to scale. In this call, we'll examine your current situation to see what is and isn't working. We'll identify your growth possibilities by the close of the year. We'll uncover the number one thing holding you and your business back. And we'll develop a growth plan that will get your business results. Go to planwithjosh.com to schedule one of the 5 complimentary growth sessions. They're going to go quickly. They always do. Can a sandwich save the world? Today we chat with Florian Fowler, who set the standard for green operations in our industry. With more than 6 restaurants under his belt, Florian proves that it's possible to scale sustainably. Today we discuss the path to profitability and sustainability as he scaled from one to many over the past 2 decades.
I think some things came together. I was working at Leo Burnett at the time at the advertising agency. I've always been a marketer and a brand person. But I was raised and educated in a Waldorf school. And I don't know if you're Waldorf schools. They're a little bit different in the way they educate kids. And we had a very big focus in the school on gardening and on food. Over many years, we had food classes. We were taught about food, about growing food, harvesting food, the bees, the whole cycle of pollination, and the importance of the various aspects of nature to bring the nutritional food to the table that we need for our bodies to sustain itself. So food has always been really important to me, and I love to eat. I'm a big eater. I love to cook. I love wine. I drink wine every day. I collect wine. I'm really into the whole thing. And so when I was at Leo Burnett, and I came from New York, I lived in New York for 8 years, and I worked at an internet firm for the art market. Art is the other big side in my family. When I came to Burnett and my newfound friends at Leo Burnett found out that I'm really into food, they said, wow, you got to go visit Whole Foods. And I was like, what is Whole Foods? There was no Whole Foods in New York. There was a Whole Foods in Chicago. So I went to Whole Foods and I looked at Whole Foods and I was like, wow, this is a game changer. This is an absolute game changer. And I went there nearly daily and I started talking to people in the aisle. I just wanted to know why they shop there and what they think about it and whether this is real. And it was very real. It was a very real change in the way people shopped for food and what they were looking for. The other change that happened, obviously, was the internet. And with the internet, information became more available. The education surrounding health moved away from being one-dimensional between your doctor and you, or maybe your nutritionist and you, or maybe your trainer in your sports studio and you, to a multitude of sources that you could go to educate yourself about what it means to live healthy, because it's not the same for everybody. Everybody has a different condition and is differently conditioned. And health means one thing to this person versus to another. But what did happen is that the overall education in what healthy food should be and is became much more broadly available. And that's, I think, also what drove the success of Whole Foods in the same time, because they made those foods available on a much bigger scale than anybody else did before. And then, of course, the third one was I had to eat every day. And I went to Leo Burnett, and I worked in the Loop here in Chicago. It's just over here out of my window. And I went to these fast casual restaurants. I would call them that at the time. And I thought they were not very inspiring. And then finally, I missed the pretzel bread that I grew up with in Stuttgart, Germany. And every pretzel bread I found was horrendous. It was just not good. And that is not a critique of the producer. They did whatever they did, the best they can, or if they thought that's all right. I felt that I can make a difference. So I brought all these ideas together and I thought, well, if Whole Foods is so successful in growing and I'm hungry and there's not a lot of differentiation going on and there's a consumer who is willing to look for a more elevated dining experience where the sandwich is not defined by meat piled high, but by the quality of the ingredients overall, I think there's a window of opportunity to do something. And that's what I founded. I founded Hannah's. I thought I'm going to do it on the side. Founded Hannah's was to be the first, it was really one of the first fast casual restaurants in Chicago based on the Whole Foods concept, focused on very interesting eating experiences, ingredients that you would not find usually at the time. I think now it's, of course, a very different story. I think the food market in the United States is extremely interesting, extremely dynamic, and incredibly resourceful and beautiful, beautiful. When I go back to Europe 10 times, 11 times a year, my mother, she's 93. She lives in Bavaria in our farmhouse. And I take care of her since many years together with my sister who lives in Berlin. And I get very much into arguments with my German friends or some Germans that I meet who have still antiquated view of the food landscape in the United States, kind of like a prejudice. And it's interesting how these perceptions stick. But I've been really amazed how food has developed over the last two decades in the United States. It's been an incredible journey. And I'm very happy that we've been part of that with Hannah's Pretzel.
And I think that a lot of the brands that have succeeded, to go back to your original statement about having a marketing background and a marketer's perspective, the people that have really thrived in this new world of food are the ones that figured out how to educate without teaching. Because nobody wants to learn. Nobody wants to go to their restaurant and learn something. The joke that I tell my coaching clients is, if you could envision driving through the drive-thru at McDonald's, and when you open the window to get your food, they're like, you know, if you drove an EV, it would be better for the environment.
Don't do that.
No, don't do that. That's not
we
what
made
people...
I got to tell you, anecdotally, we made that mistake. I did it once, and I learned a very hard lesson. We removed the salt from the pretzel bread and replaced it with sesame seeds. Because obviously salt is an issue, and then sesame seeds are obviously much more beneficial health-wise. And within a month, we reversed that. And we got seriously. And this was a classic, like us telling them how to live healthy.
Right.
Us telling the customer, you should live healthy. This is how you do it. They were like, that's my choice. Don't do this. Okay, so if anything, you should add a pretzel bread that has sesame on it so that the person that doesn't want the salt can do it. But operationally, that is not intelligent. So we just reversed it and called it a day.
So from the outset, and I mean, I think your website is a beautiful illustration of how to tell a story in a way that inspires, creates impact, creates adoption. But within the four walls of the restaurant, when you first opened and you had this mission, this ideology, how do you sell it to people without ramming it down their throat? How do you do it in a way that comes off as inspiring, not holier than thou?
Yeah, well, I think in the very beginning, in 2005, when we opened the doors, there was not a whole lot yet of what we take for granted today in terms of environmentally more conscious ways of operating. It was more focused on the ingredients at the time and on the differentness of the food. Less so on, we didn't start with wind and solar. We didn't start with biodegradable. Biodegradable didn't come along until 2006, 7, 8, something around that. Don't hold me to the exact year, please, okay? I just knew that from the get-go, and that was, again, one of my very first experiences in the United States because it was very different from my experiences in Europe. When I moved to New York, my very first lunch, I was taken to a deli. I bought a sandwich and I bought a drink The sandwich came in a wrap paper, was put into a bag. The bag was put into a plastic bag. The drink was put into a paper bag, into the plastic bag. The guy took about 20 napkins into the plastic bag. Then he threw in 3 mustards, 3 ketchups, salt, pepper. And with this bag, I went back to the office. I sat down, ate the sandwich, drank the drink, put it back in the bag, threw everything away. And then I turned to my friends in the company and I said, is this amount of garbage a daily experience? And they were like, yeah, this is how it is here. They just do it. I was like, that's crazy. That's crazy how many resources that somebody pays for get put into this bag without even knowing whether I need them or not, only to be thrown away. And every office I went to had these big collecting units filled with salt, pepper, ketchup, and mustard and mayonnaise from all the sandwiches that were carried back into offices from lunch experiences. So what we did from the beginning was we limited to 1 napkin, everybody. Okay. It was a new experience at the time. Some customers came like, there's only not 1 napkin. I need another 10 napkins. And I actually asked them like, why do you need 10 napkins? They were like, well, I want to have as many napkins as I want. And I was like, well, yeah, but it's resources. It's resources. Do you think 3 will do? But this is ridiculous. I was like, well, is it? So I got a little bit into arguments sometimes, and I just challenged the status quo. But I try to be very subtle about it and more conversational when there's the right moment. And I think then over the years, as the discussion became more broadly accepted in society on how we treat resources in our society and how we go about things, I think that the attitude shifted greatly. Today, I don't have any of those moments anymore. That's a thing of the past. And we still do only 1 napkin per customer.
Did you have a muse when you started, Hannah? Did you think, oh, well, I wanted to have the attributes of this brand and the policies of this brand? As someone that came from outside the industry, how did you cobble together a successful brand?
Well, I mean, Whole Foods was very inspiring to me. I gotta say, Whole Foods was very inspiring to me. The whole idea of looking at the entire value chain and have a positive impact on it all. B Companies is another one. I thought these ideas were very, very intriguing. And that you look at all stakeholders and define who your stakeholders are and how your culture and how your company is going to touch all stakeholders, ideally in a positive and way with a positive outcome. So when I started Hannah's, I just really felt that I want to reduce the amount of garbage that is produced. I just felt that that is not necessary, which also helps the bottom line. Okay. Because in the end, we are for-profit business. Don't kid yourself. I mean, I'm not doing this because I just want to be like, oh, recycling and composting. I do this for a living and I want to make a living. I want to provide my team with a great living. And I want to have a positive impact on the community in the way we operate and with the food that we provide. And so far, so good. 18 years and counting. So at the very beginning, you turn to brands that you find inspiring. And as in anything in design and art and anything, you steal a little bit here and you steal a little bit there. And that's what we did. That's what I did. And you go about the market in creating the brand, not so much about necessarily only what you want to do, but the competitive environment allows you to do. So if we took red and brown, because red and brown was the choice that is available. I love red in retail. I think it's the strongest retail color, right? Then second strongest is probably yellow. But red is the strongest retail color. And if red is available, then red it is. So we chose red. We went into Uber sandwich makers pretty early before Uber existed. When Uber came along, we had a couple people walk into Hannah's Pretzel wanting to apply for driving an Uber. We had to tell them this is not the right place. We stayed with Uber because I don't think this is a problem. And so we just created this tagline, Uber Sandwich Maker, and that became a cultural guideline to us on how we go about our business, which means we try to be Uber in any way. And that is how we treat our team, how we treat each other, how we treat our stakeholders, how we treat our community, what food we prepare, what ingredients we use, how we ethically go about the business. And I know you're going to drill into me pretty soon about the sustainability. And I'm very happy that you do, because I've seen too many times brands putting on the mantle. And then once you start digging, you come to realize there's not a lot there. And so we are adamant. Look, I could have so many times said, you know what? forget about the wind and solar, or forget about the biodegradable. Let's use good old plastic, styrofoam. People will never know. They won't realize. Let's not use organic flour anymore for the bread that we've been doing for 18 years. Let's just use regular bread. Once you go down that path, you set your culture up to be a culture that is deceitful. Your reputation suffers. It's not smart. So Uber is really our guiding light in everything we do. And there's always room for improvement. Every year is an opportunity to add another value to the value chain.
Before my own path to sustainability, I would have looked at a guy like you and I would have said one of two things, cynically. Either he doesn't make any money, like this guy, sure, he's sustainable, but he doesn't make any money. Or this guy makes so much money that he can afford to do sustainability. Like, yeah. Right? It's one or the other, right? Because sustainability isn't for me. It isn't for my restaurant. It's for people that either want to make no money or people that already make so much money that it's like a blip on their P&L. But the conversation that I want to have in a really granular way is, for the people listening that own single locations or they're mid-market and they own a dozen locations, what does the path to sustainability look like practically, affordably, and in a way that actually helps the bottom line and doesn't hurt it?
Well, that's a lot. Okay.
It is.
It is. We didn't do all the things we do today from day one. We grew into them. And I think that's the way to look at it, right? The very, very, very first thing I wanted to change and see change when I started Hannah's was the packaging. The packaging is the biggest environmental impact of a business like mine due to the takeout nature that we have, which is larger now than it has ever been. 70% of what we order, what we sell now gets ordered online. Over 65% of what we sell gets either picked up or delivered. So all that packaging, all the things that we use to bring the food to our customers has an enormous impact in the waste cycle. And so back in, my goodness, 06, 07, the first biodegradable things came up. Our supplier came like, hey, I've got some new things. They're called biodegradable. Apparently they compost when you put it in the waste cycle. There's been a lot of talk about this. It goes in the waste cycle, but then it's biodegrading and then it's causing gases and all that. I don't want to dive into that right now. I still believe it's better than plastic. But when that became available, we switched. We decided we're going to do this. Okay. We calculated on the packaging that we have and the amount of transactions we have per year, what the cost impact is. And we adjusted the price accordingly and said, you know, we're not even making money on this. We're just adding 5 cents to the price. And that covers the incremental expense at that time. And I'm making this up right now. I don't know. I don't exactly remember it back into 06, sure, which is a long time ago, what the exact number was. But that's how we went about it. We went, okay, here's the packaging needs for this year. This is how many things we think we're going to sell. This is the packaging cost for non-biodegradable. This is packaging cost. If we go biodegradable, this is the difference divided by transactions. This is the cost per transaction. Boom, we raised the price. Not a problem.
And there weren't riots in the streets. People weren't picketing over the
God,
five
no.
to 25.
Actually, a lot of people were like, oh, wow, really? Biodegradable? That is amazing. That is amazing. That's awesome. I think that a lot of brands overlook the incredible benefit of the positivity that a change of a company that cares, that uses its resources to make a positive change in the market towards something like waste. I think there's a lot to harvest there. I'm amazed how some companies in our food industry, and I would call them McDonald's, even Starbucks, even how little they have done, how little they have used that brand tool to make their brand shine more. I'm really amazed. It should be at the forefront. It should be at the forefront. But I think it's growing.
When you start a restaurant, most of us have a servant's heart. We're looking to serve the community. And every professional success I've ever had has been rooted in authentically creating something selfishly for myself. And I have the strategic advantage of being ordinary, incredibly ordinary. What I like, everyone likes, as it turns out. How wonderful that I can talk to myself in my marketing and I can create things that I want to see exist in the world. And it resonates because we don't live on an island. And by and large, what you like through the most authentic lens, other people will connect with. And so everything that you did. I don't believe you did it thinking, well, this is something they'll really like. It came from a more deep-seated, authentic place of, this is what I would like to see exist in the world. And in sharing that vision and that mission with people, you were able to create, I would argue, a cult following in what is a very competitive market.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been around 18 years. We survived the financial crisis, COVID, gluten-free trend. Gluten-free trend really hurt us. That was crazy. Then the other big one was when the online ordering happened and it flattened out the competitive landscape and pretty much any restaurant in the city of Chicago suddenly was your competition. You didn't own your 4-block radius anymore, which you did before. But yeah, we've been around the block and it is a very competitive environment for sure. You need to be on your feet every single day and really think on your feet particularly and be driven and be purposeful. But I think what helped us sustain it for all these years is that we're different, that we do things differently. I think it also is good that we're not huge. Typically, and I've seen many of my friends grow their businesses, grow beyond Chicago, growth, 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 growth. Very often, what happens is that the investors behind the restaurants become more diversified and ever so larger. And then ultimately, the financial performance takes priority over anything else. And that is understandable, but is not sometimes the most positive aspect for a brand. And we were lucky to be independent and stay independent so we could be dedicated to how we want to operate and the style and the manner in which we do. And I think that has served us really well.
Let's talk about marketing. If you were to ask me to simplify what restaurant marketing looks like, it's two things. It's letting people know you exist and then reminding them that you exist. And we could get into the nuance, but those are really your two big jobs. And so you look at an 18-year-old brand and you look at the dynamic shifts in the market over the last 18 years. I can flash you back to 2014. Sitting with my business partner and executive chef talking about sustainability. And he was like, we're going to turn this into a fully sustainable enterprise. And I said, will it be expensive? And he goes, yes. And I said, swear to God, this is a conversation. And like, you can imagine how timid and scared I am. I said, will it be expensive? And he goes, yes. And I said, do you think people will care? And he goes, probably not. And in 2014, that was very much the case. There was a vocal minority that supported what we did. And they were like, oh my goodness, I found you through the Seafood Watch app and all of this. But I mean, I was playing to an audience of 7 people in Los Angeles.
Oh yeah.
But it's changed. I would assume that because the market has changed, the values of the market has changed and your business has evolved over time. You've evolved as an entrepreneur. How do you look at those two facets? Number one, creating awareness, because I would argue that even 18 years in, the likelihood of you standing in front of your place and bumping into someone and them having no idea that your restaurant exists is still highly likely.
Oh, very likely. It's daily, actually.
It's shocking to me.
Yeah.
But what is your perspective on awareness, the most effective ways to get it with your background as a marketer? And then in terms of frequency and reminding people that you exist and giving them reasons to return. What does that look like in practical application?
Yeah, so after 18 years, you have a pretty deep customer list. And I'm a big believer that you focus on your existing customers, your marketing efforts, rather than trying to hunt down the one that you don't know who they are and where they are, but they eventually exist somewhere. That's the first one. The second one is the beauty of catering. We cater to a lot of companies. I love the catering aspect because the catering aspect is me finding those new customers. Companies have new employees come into the workforce, they move to Chicago, they join a big company, call it Edelman PR or Gensler, the architecture firm, or Blue Cross Blue Shield, whoever we cater to. They have a meeting, 50 new people, Deloitte orders from us a lot. A lot of times it's like, oh, this time we have a group of 80 new employees, it's their first day, and boom, they get exposed to Hannah's Pretzel. And typically that has really always helped us grow the business. In marketing today, you can go absolutely bonkers in data analytics. You can go into the Googles and into the Facebooks and go granular and the average check and product mix and this, that, and the other. And in the end of the day, I wonder, though, what exactly are you going to do with all that data once you're done with your analytics? And to what degree do you really drive the marketing for a company our size? I think that if you're larger, if you're in multiple markets, that might be different. I could have a very different market profile in, let's say, if I go to New York, or I go to LA, or I go to a St. Louis or Minneapolis, or I would go to Charlotte or Miami. And I think that might impact menu and pricing, these kind of sensible items. But I'm a huge fan of keeping it simple. I think you need to do much more work the more average your product is. And I think you need to do much less work the more differentiated and quality the product is. So we have always focused on the product first. Because I think if you come in and you eat something that is very tasty and you come to realize the ingredients are good and clean and you feel good after, and then you learn a little bit more about the company because it intrigues you, or maybe you looked around in the store and we communicate from the walls our heritage and our environmental efforts and the things we do. And then you go back another day and you start talking to the team and they explain how they love to work there and they smile and they say thank you and they're appreciative. You start building an emotional relationship to the brand. And so we have really always focused much more on producing this elevated food experience than on the marketing drilling down into the nitty-gritty and, oh my God, let's do this, that, or the other, or catch them with their credit cards. And look, we just introduced a loyalty program called the Sandwich Club, right? Guess what? You don't need to do anything to participate. You just need to write your email down at hannaspretzel.com. You can sign up. Once we have your email, you're part of the club. And what do? Well, we just launched a chef series sandwich with Paul Kahn from One of Hospitality, Blackbird, Publican Quality Meats, Bread, a wonderful, wonderful group of people doing wonderful, wonderful food things in Chicago. I love them. I love them. And I think the city of Chicago owes them a huge thanks for all the wonderful things they've been doing. And Paul created a great sandwich, and 25% of the proceeds will go to one of his partners, Edward Sladen, has a dog rescue side gig, and we're going to donate 25% of the revenue, not profits, revenue. Again, like not washing the numbers, right? Because what is profit? No, revenue, cold hard money made. 25% goes to his organization to rescue dogs, because we all love dogs. I love dogs. I have two dogs over there. Luckily, they're behaving and not barking right now. And what did we do for the Sandwich Club? For the Sandwich Club, we sent to the entire Sandwich Club community an invitation to try the sandwich at 20% off. You get deals. We will do one with a fitness place where I work out called Basecamp, where for a week, the Sandwich Club members can try it out for free. We're trying to open doors. We're trying to open dialogue. And we're not doing this because you bought a sandwich or you buy 10 sandwiches or 20 sandwiches a month. I appreciate every customer we have. I appreciate them if they buy 10 sandwiches. I appreciate them if they buy one sandwiches. And I want to open up the community. I want to keep it simple in the process. I don't want to count points and automate it, because the automation becomes rational. And I like brands with an emotional connection. Leo Burnett was always about the emotional connection in brands. And I find most loyalty programs are deal programs. They're like a rational deal.
A transaction, okay. 100%. Transaction.
Yeah, you've been there 10 times. I'll give you a free sandwich.
Here's a pickle.
Yeah, and I go to all these businesses and they all have that now and everybody has these programs and I just don't see what the value is. And I'm completely wrong. I tell you, there is value because obviously everybody's doing it, so there must be value, right? And I think that with some, like I would say Starbucks does a really good job, but they have resources beyond me. And so we wanted to keep it simple. I like to keep things really simple. And there is the other aspect of charm. I think charm is one of the most overlooked terms in the United States when it comes to marketing. We try to do a lot of charm things. Like we hand out chocolates to customers on a given day just because we like to. There's umbrellas in our entrance. If it rains, you can take the umbrella for free. It's branded. Okay. It says bring it back when you can. We've been going through, I don't know, it's about 3,000 umbrellas by now or something like this. It's part of our charm initiative. We empower our GMs to invite customers that are repeat customers and say, hey, today lunch is on me. Thanks for coming in all the time. I think that goes much further because it's recognition of the person on the merit of their having a relationship with us rather than on the transactional side. And of course, that's scary because it's not really that measurable.
Right. How do you measure surprise and delight?
For sure. Right. And when it's not measurable, we from a management side, we're like, what? Is that really working? Is it not working? I'm like, it is working. I just can't tell you how much it's working, but we are in business. We're doing well. We have loyal customers. They're happy. They're our brand ambassadors out there because I like brand ambassadors. And they will tell other people about, you got to eat at Hannes Pretzel. And I've been around for 18 years against all the big guns in the city. And so I think there's something to it.
There is, but that's your job. It's the founder. It's one thing to say surprise and delight and let's surprise people, but you've got to put tools in place for people. You've got to put guardrails in place for them. I was just consulting on this massive project in Whitefish, Montana. And I come in and I'd say, you know, one of our core focuses is going to be that people feel seen and special. And our greatest tool to do that is surprise and delight. And everybody nodded their head. And then my next question was, what does that look like in practical application? Crickets, right? Because yeah. They need tools because, yeah. Because that's an aspirational
tool. Yeah.
That's an aspirational thought. That's not an organizational operational thought. And so I said, these are 10 things that you can do any night of the week that'll make people feel seen and special. And so I'm sure a lot of the folks listening aspire to have that kind of culture, not realizing that it's something that has to be carved out of stone. These are the buttons in the POS. This is how often you can do it. These are all the tools at your disposal. This is how you would relate that information to a customer. This is how you leverage your team to get the word out. There's so much operational and organizational infrastructure to delight that I think most people fail to realize it. And it just stays as this large, broad, aspirational thing. When like it's a system, as you're explaining, that you can put into place, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it works for us. It's like we've learned over the years from emails I get. And, you know, there's this famous thing, like when one person emails 25 to 20 or 30, others feel the exact same way. It's a channel research rule. But emails from like, oh, my God, you saved my day. I was at your store. It rained. I didn't realize. I had a meeting right after. I would have been soaking wet. Or I had to miss my meeting. And your umbrella is my lifesaver. I will love you forever. I'll let everybody know to go to Hannes.
That's it. Mwah. You can't buy that.
That's
you
it.
You can't buy that, right? For an $8 umbrella.
No.
Amazing.
No. No.
Best money you ever spent.
They're nice umbrellas, wooden handles, and they're really large. They're large because I always say do it right or don't do it at all. So it's not the skimpy little one that you can barely fit underneath so that we can say we have an umbrella, but it's really a crappy, shitty, plasticky one. No. It's a big umbrella, big, bright red, and two people fit under it. And if you hold on to it and walk around with a brand on it, it's fine with me. So this is like the charm is important and the loyalty program that we did. I like simplicity to come back full circle when it comes to marketing. I don't want to sit at my desk all day long and crunch numbers to do what? To find out what? I just still sometimes think that for a brand like my size, that is not necessary. I think that the focus should be more on the product and the quality of the experience. That will work by itself.
I've got one last question for you.
Sure.
High level.
Yeah.
The restaurant industry is filled with unspoken rules and traditions about how things should be done. How would you like to see our industry turn the tables to create a better future for all of us?
Oh, boy, that's a huge question. That's hard because, I mean, you say restaurant industry. There's so many different segments in the restaurant industry, right? Look, in the end of the day, when I talk to my team about our restaurant, I don't use the word restaurant. I use the word hospitality and to be hospitable. And there's a lot of talk right now about AI and about automation. I think Sweetgreens is experimenting with an automated line, no employees anymore, where the salad gets dropped out and the ingredients get dropped out exactly measured to the T, and then the sauce gets put on. And in the end, it's a package. And then there's only a register person that hands you that. And you know what? Why not? Some people might like that. Some people don't like human interaction. Me, when it comes to food, I like to smell, feel, touch. I like to talk, but maybe I'm old school. I don't know. Maybe it's a generational thing. What do I know? But I love to go food shopping. I have a lot of friends who hate food shopping. They don't want to go to a grocery store. They order everything online, gets delivered to their house. I love to go into a grocery store. I like to see, I smell, and discover. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But I'm a touchy-feely, smelly, trying kind of a person. And so the automation is not something for me. I would not go into a place where there's no human being and I press a button or digitally ordering and then suddenly it makes kaplonk and there's your food and I don't know where it came from and what it is. I like Hannah's from the aspect that I order the sandwich and they slice the bread and they slice the meats. And oh, by the way, Subway discovered that slicing meats is something. Wow. And so now, congratulations. I just don't know how they're going to pull it off with all the locations. But, you know, that's their headache, not mine. But anyway, slicing the meats, which we did since 2005. Congratulations, Subway. And then the sandwich is put together. And what our customers love is that moment where they can watch the production of what they're going to eat. And also that they have the ability to have input at that moment where they say, you know what, I would rather have cucumbers than tomatoes on my sandwich. And I think that is golden. And we will never, ever change and touch that. I will never, ever automate our line where some robot is cutting the bread and another one slices a perfect Parma ham on it. And then comes the perfectly sliced tomato, which is exactly 1.8 ounces as per recipe and blah, 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 blah. Yes, for the bottom line, phenomenal. Okay, right? From the interaction and the human experience and the loyalty to the brand, absolutely not. Never, ever, ever. I'd rather have no business. So where is the future of restaurants? I think it's in the human interaction. We're social animals. Look at what COVID did. There's always this desire to take the human out of it because, yeah, we make mistakes and we cost money. But I think in the restaurant business, it's all about the human interaction. And if you go to a place where you have a positive human interaction, that's the place you go back to again, as long as the rest of the food experience is up to the same level of quality as the human interaction, right? So if the value chain is positive, they have your share of wallet for a very long time. And I think as much as things change, things stay the same.
Our industry suffers from razor-thin margins, and the only way for us to ensure profitability is to make data-driven decisions. The numbers don't lie, and Yelp for Restaurants just released some incredibly compelling numbers. For starters, Yelp reaches 9 times more customers online than OpenTable. And when restaurants pair that level of visibility with Guest Manager and Yelp ads, they experience up to an 8% lift in diner bookings. Think about what that 8% lift could do for your restaurant's finances. To learn more about how Yelp for Restaurants can support your business, visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to learn more today. That's Florian Fowler. For more information on Hannah's Bretzel, visit hannahsbretzel.com. If you want to tell us your story, hear previous episodes, or check out our other content, go to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp. Thank you so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, please leave us a review. A special thanks to Yelp for helping us spread the word to the whole hospitality community. I'm Josh Kopel. You've been listening to Full Comp.